Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Jeanette Winterson about her new memoir, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal.
For a child who longs for symbol and for stories and for ideas, that was a perfect way to fill me up with something I could use later. So I wasn't sitting on the step empty, I was sitting on the step full.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Moral psychologist Jonathan Haidt tells us the difference between conservatives and liberals.
The liberal moral worldview rests primarily on concerns about care, compassion, and that makes them experts in finding victims and helping them. But conservatives are more sensitive to issues of loyalty, authority, sanctity.
Charles McGrath tells us about three golfers who revolutionized the game. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Jeanette Winterson is one of the most admired and successful novelists in the English language, and she is now a memoirist. She's written a new book. It's called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal. It's reviewed on our cover by distinguished critic Catherine Harrison, who says that Winterson's book is winning, courageous, and has imagination and talent. And I'm delighted that Jeanette is here from London to talk about her book. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mom, let's start with your mother, Mrs. Winterson. Quite an amazing character.
Yeah, I call her a monster, but I say she was my monster. You know, she was the big screen character in the small screen of our lives. She had operatic dimensions. She was a flamboyant depressive. I mean, this was a woman who kept a revolver in the duster drawer, you know, and the bullets in a tin of polish. And she was an evangelical, a Pentecostal. She adopted me because she wanted a baby. And I don't think she ever really had sex with my father, so naturally she wasn't going to have a baby. But she wanted me to be a missionary and to go out there and save souls. But it went wrong because she was ill-prepared for the creature that she got. There was something rather fairy tale about it. You know, you suddenly look in the basket and there's the changeling and it's got little cat ears or furry whiskers or spots. And I think that's what happened when she looked down at me. And she said, "The devil led us to the wrong crib." And that was the beginning of the dark narrative.
And yes, you describe it with such wit and generosity and humor, as Catherine Harrison says, but it wasn't always fun living in that household. In fact, it could be quite brutal.
It was brutal. She used to lock me in the coal hole, and she'd lock me outside on the front step at night if she was angry with me. She would never sleep in the same bed as my father, so it all depended on whether he was on shift work. So my punishments were rather random, but they were specific. But when I was locked out like that, what could I do? Either I could just blank out completely, or I could disappear into my head, which I was able to do, because one of the strengths of my upbringing was that I had the Bible read to me every day. Mrs. Winston read it out loud to me and my father, and she liked to stand up and do this, start at Genesis, end at Revelation. And that is fabulous language and extraordinary stories. And for a child who longs for symbol and for stories and for ideas, that was a perfect way to fill me up with something I could use later. So I wasn't sitting on the step empty, I was sitting on the step full. And from the stories that I knew, I was able to invent my own stories. And that's what kept me going.
In some ways, she made you the writer you became.
She did, and she used to go around the house, because books were forbidden in our house because she was afraid of secular influences, but she would write things out and stick them all over the place. So we lived in a world of print because she was a pamphleteer by temperament. So under my coat peg it said, "Think of God, not the dog." And then over the oven it said, "Man shall not live by bread alone." It got a bit spookier if you went to the outside toilet, because those who stood up read, "Linger not at the Lord's business." And those who sat down read, "He shall melt thy bowels like wax."
And what about your father? He just was no match for her.
No match. My father, he was a good man, but he was a weak man, and he was overwhelmed by the force of Mrs. Winterson. You know, she's a big woman, as well as being...
Very big
woman. I mean, she was 5'10", and she weighed 20 stone. You know, and I'm small, I'm 5 foot, and I'm light.
And 20 stone, for our American audience, about 280 pounds.
I guess that's right, yeah. So, you know, she in the tiny house, we used to call them two up, two down, two rooms downstairs, two rooms upstairs, no bathroom or anything, little terraces. Of course, you know, she filled the house. She was like a creature out of a fairy story, where, you know, where size is approximate and unstable. So she loomed up, and she seemed like this great figure crouched under the gloomy shelf of her life, too big for it, breaking out of it. And of course, we were the ones who suffered. I mean, sometimes the revolver would come out, and Dad and me didn't know if we would see the morning. And add to that she lived in end time because she was waiting for the apocalypse. You know, she was an eschatologist. She wanted the world to blow up. You know, I used to say to her, why did God make such a dump as Accrington, which is my small town where I grew up? And she said, I know, but it doesn't matter because it will all be destroyed.
Now, what about when you emerged as a brilliant and provocative and sort of game-changing novelist? And what did she make of that? Was she even alive for any of that?
She was alive when Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit was published, which is my first novel, and that's 1985. And it is semi-autobiographical. You know, it's based on events in my own life. And I do call the main character Jeanette, because I thought that would be an exciting thing to do, to read yourself as a fiction as well as a fact. And she did read it, and she asked me to telephone her, and I had no phone and she had no phone, so we went to our phone booths and I called her, and there she was. And she said to me, it's the first time I've had to order a book in a false name. And she was furious, and she kept saying, but it's not true, you know. And I thought this was extraordinary from a woman who'd explained the flash dash of mice activity in the kitchen as ectoplasm.
And what became of the marriage once you left home? And you went to Oxford, right?
Yes,
literature
I did.
There. How were you able to do that, by the way? I mean, Oxford's not an easy university to be admitted into. How were you able to nurture this literary, intellectual life? Was it a kind of secret you kept?
It was certainly a secret when I was at home, because of books being forbidden in our house. I used to have to hide them under the bed. And your listeners will know that if you've got a single bed standard size and a collection of paperback standard size, you can get 72 per layer under the mattress. They could try this. And I also read in the library. It was an old-fashioned library built with Carnegie money, actually, in 1907. And it had huge shelves at the back, which was English literature in prose A to Z. So I just started at A because I didn't know what to do, and I thought I'll just work my way through. And of course it's good at the beginning because you get Austin and the Brontes and Dickens and Eliot, so you feel quite buoyed up and you go on. It's when I got to Nabokov I got a bit depressed, and I think that was the beginning of my feminism. But because I'd read so much, I started to understand words. Do you know the way that boys understand engines and can just strip them out and put them back together? That was my life and my world. And so I was able to take that to the entrance exam at Oxford, and although I had no advantages, I had something, and they decided to give me a chance.
Thanks so much, Jeanette.
Thank you.
That's Jeanette Winterson, whose new memoir, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Navy SEALs, we can't get enough of them.
Yes, the publishing industry is a tough place these days, but not if you are a Navy SEAL.
Julie, after the remarkable capture and killing of Osama bin Laden, Americans developed a fascination with Navy SEALs, and it seems to be growing. There are more books coming out, is that right?
It is, and you know, sometimes the publishing industry, when one book takes off, everyone runs in the same direction, and this seems to be one of those cases. After Osama bin Laden was killed last year, St. Martin's Press happened to have a book ready to go called SEAL Team 6, and they moved up the publication date so that the book would come out right away. And sure enough, the book became a huge bestseller. It was such a bestseller, in fact, that St. Martin's is going to publish a young adult version of the book in April called I Am a SEAL Team 6 Warrior. And what that book is just one example of books by Navy SEALs and other members of the military that have come out in the last year or will come out in next fall or next spring that are sort of the next generation of writings from the war. We've seen a lot of books from journalists who have been embedded with the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, but now we're seeing a lot of stories from the warriors.
Julie, this may be an impossible question for you to answer. I'm going to ask it anyway. Do we know if books like these need to be vetted by the U.S. Navy? Or we know, for instance, with intelligence books by CIA officers, there's a very rigid procedure they have to follow. Do we have any idea what rules are in place for these authors?
They are required to be vetted by the Department of Defense. And I talked to one of the editors of these books, and he said that it was, you know, it was a rigorous vetting, that the DOD read the book, checked for classified information, you know, made a couple of changes. But for the most part, they didn't change too much. And in fact, you know, one could argue that the government doesn't really mind all of these books that, you know, portray SEALs as incredibly heroic, brave, kind of magical figures that really captivate readers and audiences with the, you know, the tales of their heroism. And the stories are incredible. One book that, you know, if you've glanced at the New York Times nonfiction hardcover bestseller list in the last few months, you've seen American Sniper by Chris Kyle. And this is a biography that was published by William Morrow in January. Mr. Kyle was a member of the Navy SEALs. He is, by some descriptions, the most successful sniper in American military history. And he so tormented the insurgents in Iraq that they put a price on his head. So these are stories that are tough to make up. I mean, there are so many, there's a long history of military history, of course, and novels about Navy SEALs. And, you know, a lot of these books now are just too much for a lot of readers to resist. Another thing that's interesting about this whole phenomenon is that publishers seem to be capturing a lot of people who don't normally buy books. When I talked to Chris Kyle, the author of American Sniper, he lives in Texas now, and he said that at his first book signing, he had more than 1,000 people attend, and the one thing that he's been hearing over and over again from people who have bought the book is that they haven't read a book since they've had to, and his book is the first that they've really been interested enough to pick up. And a lot of the people who are buying these books are hearing about them on conservative media, on Fox and Friends, on talk radio. So it's really that kind of elusive reader who doesn't normally walk into a bookstore, but publishers are finding them through other means.
And not to play the gender game here, but we're assuming a lot of these readers are men and guys. So maybe it's a good idea to do YA versions or versions of some kind for younger readers, since we know that the reluctant reader, the reluctant boy, young boy, is one of the real concerns parents and librarians have. Do we have any sense of whether kids are interested in these books? And
it does seem like the people who are buying these books are men. A lot of men, you know, who live in rural areas. Yeah, I mean, it seems like some of the books that are coming out in YA versions would certainly be incredibly appealing to teenagers, to adolescents who find military stories interesting, as, you know, the people in older generations do.
And I guess the video games will be next. Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
In these increasingly polarized times, some scholars have been looking at the profound differences between conservatives and liberals. One such scholar is Jonathan Haidt, author of The Righteous Mind: Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. It's reviewed for us this week by William Salatan, who says, "The righteous mind isn't just about manipulating people who disagree with you, it's about learning from them." Jonathan Haidt recently visited The Times, and we sat down for a conversation. Welcome, Jonathan. We'll talk about your book. Congratulations.
Thanks.
All right, here we are at a time when conservatives and liberals really are at dagger's point. And you think there actually is a way out of it?
As for whether there's a way out, you'll have to ask political scientists. The kinds of changes we need to make to our electoral system, funding elections, those are the fixes that are going to make a big difference in the long run. What I'm hoping to do is prepare the ground for that by just helping people understand, you know what, the other side isn't evil, crazy, or stupid. They see certain moral truths. They see certain principles of a good society that you don't see.
Now, one of the arguments you make is that in some areas, conservatives actually may have a more expansive, moral vision than liberals. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
That's right. So my colleagues and I run a website at yourmorals.org. We have data from about 200,000 people. What we find is that liberals, the liberal moral worldview rests primarily on concerns about care, compassion, and that makes them experts in finding victims and helping them. But conservatives are more sensitive to issues of loyalty, authority, sanctity. These things sound kind of weird to liberals. They sound kind of, you know, tribal and primitive. But you can't really run a good society without them. We evolved to live in these little groups based on kinship and reciprocity. And somehow civilizations have grown vast, and we can interact with strangers, and we can create these vast cooperative societies. But if you don't have a sense of authority and moral order, it's all going to decay. And this is the great insight that conservatives have had since the 18th century, since Edmund Burke and others. You have to take steps to preserve moral order. Conservatives are experts at that. Liberals are kind of wary about it.
And let's take a candidate whose views many find extreme, Rick Santorum,
mm-hmm.
who
yes.
now has emerged as a real force within the Republican Party. He's the strongest challenger to Mitt Romney, and many women in America recoil from his mm-hmm. arguments. When you hear Rick Santorum, how do you interpret the arguments he's making?
Santorum is speaking primarily from one of the six moral foundations, the Sanctity Foundation. This is one of the foundations that was at the heart of the older culture war. From the 80s, from the time the religious right joined up with the Republican Party in the 70s, really through the financial crash, the culture war was mostly about the religious right, people who believed that the world wasn't just a material place where we could manipulate it and do what we wanted. They believed God made it, God lives in it, there should be boundaries, versus the secular liberals who thought, let's just maximize utility. Let's use social policy to improve everybody's lives. So that's the older culture war, which featured issues that seemed crazy and irrational to liberals, like should we have a constitutional amendment to protect the flag? It's just a piece of cloth. Social conservatives, such as Santorum, want to live in a more sacralized world. They want to live in a world based more, in many cases, on the Bible or on Christianity. That culture war kind of faded out with the rise of the Tea Party and the enormous financial problems we've been facing. But now with all the controversy over birth control issues, those were just so perfectly timed to let him speak about the issues where he's strongest.
One of the points you've made, and our reviewer Will Salatan does too, that there was a time really during the Bush years when a number of academicians or liberal thinkers coming out of the university were making arguments about conservatism mm-hmm. and liberalism. Right. They made a quite different argument from yours. Theirs was, well, conservatives are really good at slogans, or they're really good at pushing
right.
buttons.
Right.
Is that a kind of short-sightedness among liberal thinkers that still mm-hmm. in some ways entraps the way they approach politics?
Right. Well, George Lakoff, Drew Weston, and I all agree that the mind
and
is
they also
fundamentally
wrote a major book. Yeah.
That's right. We all agree that the mind is fundamentally intuitive, emotional. It's not very good at reasoning to find the truth. So we're all on the same page there psychologically. But in terms of describing conservatives and whether it's just that the Republicans are so good at pushing buttons, that's why they trick people, that's more the Thomas Frank thesis, the what's the matter with Kansas thesis. And that's one that, as far as I know, most political scientists have rejected. And I think moral psychology gives us a very different kind of a response to Frank. Working class people in Kansas and elsewhere aren't voting against their self-interest when they vote Republican. They're voting for the kind of world they want to live in. And it's often more the kind of world that Rick Santorum wants, a world that they think has some meaning, has some order, a world in which bad deeds get punished and slackers and cheaters don't get rewarded with federal subsidies. Politics is not really about self-interest primarily. It's really more about sacred values and sacred issues. And that's true for the left and the right.
Is it possible to make the argument too? Here's something that a liberal might find contradictory or self-contradictory, part of a conservative, that someone who is, say, quite dependent on what some call the welfare state, mm-hmm. like Medicare and Social Security, right. and who might even have been victimized by the crash of 2008, mm-hmm. objects to larger government and also objects to excessive regulation of Wall mm-hmm. Street. Right. Is it possible that those really are not contradictory positions?
Well, all of us are inconsistent and hypocritical because the part of our minds that does the reasoning is not really connected to the part of our minds that does the judging, and is not connected to the part of mind that does the behaving. So there have been a lot of articles in the Times recently about how in red states they tend to get more federal subsidies than in blue states. And sure, this is hypocritical. But I think the trick to understanding the hatred of government, for libertarians, it truly is a hatred of government. But for the social conservatives, I think what's really going on here is not a hatred of government per se. It's a hatred of an activist government that became activist under Roosevelt and even the progressives before, but it really stepped up in the 60s. That's what they hate. So that famous line from one of the Tea Party, you know, get your government hands off my Medicare. It's not Medicare and Social Security that they mind. They fixate, I think, too much, but they fixate on welfare policies and a government focused on helping the poor, and especially the African-American poor, in terms of race-based quotas, affirmative action, things like that, that really anger the white working class. So it's not all government they hate. It's a kind of an activist liberal government, as they perceive it.
Jonathan, one distinction between your work and some of others who are writing about politics is it really is based on research, psychological research. Mm-hmm. How do you find the answers to these questions? Who are these 200,000 people, and what is it you're learning about them? How do you get at this information?
Right. Well, each researcher has their own methods, their own questions, and so they come to, say, political psychology from a different perspective. Drew Westen was a clinical psychologist. George Lakoff is a cognitive scientist. I studied culture, and I'm sorry, I studied morality and how morality varies across cultures. So that's what I bring. And in 2004, especially after the Kerry defeat, you know, I was like pulling my hair out. I mean, I was a partisan liberal back then, and I'd hear Kerry saying things like, America can do better, and help is on the way. It's like, what are you doing? This is, you know, these don't push any moral buttons. This is just, this does not connect with people. So I started studying politics as culture. I started looking at the left and the right in this country as I had looked at different nations. And as soon as I did that, I saw these sort of neat splits between the moral foundations that both sides endorse. As a psychologist, I want to focus on what's universal and innate, but then I also want to see how, from that universal foundation, you can get such different moralities, even within the same nation, with the left and the right.
Thanks so much. That's Jonathan Haidt, whose new book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, is reviewed in this week's book review.
You can find video of my conversation with Jonathan Haidt on the Times website.
Golf is one of those sports that always seems to be on the verge of reinventing itself. There's an important new book called American Triumvirate, Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, Ben Hogan, and the Modern Age of Golf. It's by James Dodson and reviewed by none other than my esteemed predecessor and writer-at-large for the New York Times, Charles McGrath, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Chip.
Hi.
Okay, so when we go back to this era, these were three really great players. And did they modernize the game?
Well, you could make a case that they did. They came along when the game was just beginning to become popular. They all sort of started to come of age in the 30s, and they certainly helped popularize golf and make it a sport that people paid attention to and even that people took up and played for themselves. They were all poor kids. They all came up through the caddy yard, and so they embodied a kind of democratic streak of golf, which, frankly, the game hadn't had a whole lot of until they came along.
Chip, what was the state of professional golf when they played? We think of someone like Bobby Jones, who was the classic amateur great player in the 20s. Was the game changing? The
game was starting to change. I mean, but you still had this thing that, for example, well into the 20s, professionals were not allowed to go into a clubhouse. So even if the professional played in a U.S. Open or a British Open, they had to change their shoes or their clothes out in the parking lot. There was the beginnings of a pro tour starting in the 20s, and then in the 30s, these guys popularized it. But it was partly a kind of traveling road show, and the money was not great in the beginning, certainly. And they made a lot of money on exhibitions. And they probably made a lot of money gambling. This is something that the books don't go into, but I suspect that that's probably was a big part of it.
And these three in particular, were they friends? Were they rivals? Were they both?
They were both. Hogan and Nelson actually grew up just a couple of miles from one another and caddied together. Snead grew up in West Virginia, and they came along. Hogan and Nelson were great friends for a while, and then the friendship frazzled under the pressure of their competition. You have to remember, all three of these guys, one or the other of them, or both of, or three, were always on the leaderboards. Sneed and Hogan became friends later on, and in some ways it was an unlikely friendship. Sneed was much more affable than Hogan, but they shared something, a kind of driven quality, a kind of private quality. So they actually, in the end, got along better.
And what about the game? Did they elevate golf through this intense competition and the professionalism, the hunger to succeed that was so different from the country club approach?
Yeah, I think they did. And they also advanced the game technically. Nelson was the guy who really kind of ushered in the transition. These guys started playing with wooden shafted clubs. And then when steel came in, that changed the nature of the swing. And it was Nelson that really shepherded that in. And then Hogan was the great perfectionist. He was the guy that began a thing that's now common of just spending hours at the range, hours and hours perfecting your swing and thinking about the tiniest little adjustments. And he wrote a book or co-authored a book which was very influential in golf instruction. So yes, I think they did raise the level of the game. And because of their personalities and the nature of their rivalry, they made it an exciting time for golf. It was fun to watch them.
And when we think of the level the sport is at now, or someone like Tiger Woods is an international celebrity, I have the sense, I don't know golf anything like the way you do, that there is a sense of history in the sport. A great player like Woods is actually familiar with the swing that Hogan used. Is that legacy really passed down generationally through the game?
Yeah, I think so. I think golf, maybe it's one of the things those of us who play like about it, more than any other sport, it does seem to have this sense of its own history. And part of it is you can go and play on the same courses, which haven't changed that much, where memorable tournaments took place. And I think that a lot of golfers are students of their own game. And the memory of these people and even of their swings kind of lingers on.
Do they have the arsenal of coaches and instructors and support that the big stars have now?
No. These guys were all self-taught, really. A lot of what they did was kind of trial and error and experimentation. That's what makes Hogan so interesting in a way. I mean, Hogan thought about it and wrote about it, but he kind of invented a technical way of thinking about the golf swing that hadn't existed before. Except for Hogan, they didn't spend a huge amount of time at the range, the golfers of that era. They certainly weren't physically fit the way we think of golfers now. And yet Sneed into his 70s supposedly could kick a door lintel by standing flat-footed. So he must have been limber at least. But no, the game was different then. In some ways more attractive. It's more exciting, and there's a kind of human quality reading about these three guys that sometimes gets lost, it seems to me, in the current version of golf.
And how is James Dotson done? He tells his story pretty well.
Yeah, he's a good golf writer. He wrote a very good and kind of important biography of Hogan, and he's written some memoirs, and it's a good story. And all you have to do is not get in the way too much, and that's what he does.
Thanks a lot, Chip.
Thank you.
That's Charles McGrath, formerly the editor of the Book Review, writer at large for The Times, who reviews American Triumvirate in this week's Book Review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, we've got Mortality and Morality. Over on the fiction side of things, the mortality comes from a book called Monday Mornings by Sanjay Gupta. You know him probably as America's Doctor. He's a neurosurgeon and the medical correspondent for CNN.
Right. He's great. In fact, didn't the Obama administration approach him at one point?
They did. Before Obama took office, but while he was still president-elect, he apparently approached Gupta to see if he was interested in being the Surgeon General. And Gupta may have thought about it. He withdrew his name from consideration, citing family concerns and just a desire to stay in Atlanta, where he lives and works.
What's in the new book?
It's a novel. It's new at number 13 on the list. It is a medical thriller about five surgeons at this fictional hospital, Chelsea General. And it is specifically about the morbidity and mortality meetings. Those are these kind of private meetings that doctors have after surgery goes wrong to hash out what happened and what steps they can take to try to fix it in the future. It's entirely separate from the malpractice system or any kind of hospital discipline action. But it's just the doctors kind of having a postmortem saying, what do we do here? How can we do better in the future? So that's new at number 13. At number 2 on the fiction list, there's a new Star Wars novel, Fate of the Jedi Apocalypse, by a guy named Troy Denning, who's a big game writer and science fiction writer. And then at number 16, Jane Green, the chick lit author, has a book called Another Piece of My Heart about tensions between a stepmother and one of her stepdaughters.
So what have we got on nonfiction?
At number 5, there's a book called Better Than Normal by the psychiatrist Dale Archer. He makes the case that all of these diagnoses we hand out for ADD and OCD and these kind of psychiatric diagnoses actually inhibit our natural strengths, and that we're over-medicating for these things, and that we should just let people be what they are. And then the morality part comes in on a book at number 6 called The Righteous Mind by the moral psychologist Jonathan Haidt.
Now, Greg, that book's getting a ton of attention. We have a very long, detailed review by William Salatin of Slate. Haidt appeared in the Sunday Review section of the paper. He has arguments to make about differences between liberals and conservatives.
Yeah, it's interesting. He started out to say, do liberals and conservatives approach morality differently? And he created a questionnaire and polled people internationally through online surveys and approached subjects. He and a research assistant sat people down and talked to them through a series of questions, different hypothetical situations. He categorized morals by about 5 or 6 different types of virtues: fairness, a desire to do no harm to other people, justice, respect for authority, sanctity, kind of a respect for sacredness or divinity, various categories. And what he found across the board was that liberals favored 2 of them much more highly than conservatives did, and that was fairness and not harming others. Conservatives also valued those things highly, just not as highly as liberals, but they also valued the other 3 or 4 virtues much more highly than liberals did. So respect for authority or belonging to an in-group, kind of a sense of group spirit or togetherness were things that mattered more to conservatives.
So he's got this survey, from what I understand, well over 100,000, maybe even as many as 200,000 people have responded. What kinds of questions does he ask, and what sort of answers does he get?
Well, it's funny. The questions that he asked are really the kind of hypotheticals I wrote in my column that you might find at a 7th grade slumber party. Like, his assistant offered somebody a cup of apple juice, and they took a sip, no problem. And then he said, here, I've got this sterilized cockroach, and I'm going to dip it into the apple juice. Now will you drink it? And he did this to test the idea of sanctity of the body, that you're somehow violating the apple juice there. The cockroach is completely sterile. It's raised in a sterile environment. They've heated it to ensure that it's sterilized before they inserted it into the juice. And only like 18% of the people would agree to do it. He's testing kind of an innate revulsion to certain things. He also asked people, if you found your pet dog dead on the side of the road, freshly killed by a car, would you bring it home and cook it up and eat it for dinner? Would that be okay? Again, most people said no. Liberals and libertarians were more inclined to say yes. Or not that they would do it, but that they wouldn't judge somebody morally for doing it. They'd say, hey, it's their business. It's not mine. They're not hurting anybody. Again, this is this question of do no harm to others. And as long as you're doing no harm, something is perfectly moral.
So our bottom line here is, don't strap the dog to your roof of your car, But it's all right to cook them up and eat them for dinner.
There you go.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.